From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Environmental groups and at least two states are promising to sue over the Trump administration's changes to how it implements the Endangered Species Act. The changes were announced yesterday, just a couple months after a UN report warned that more than a million plants and animals around the world could face extinction, some within decades. Joining us now on Skype is Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director for the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the groups promising to sue. He's in Portland, Oregon. Noah, what's most concerning to you about these changes?
Well, these changes are just a disaster for endangered species and are a sweeping change to the way that the Endangered Species Act is implemented in a way that will just substantially weaken protections, including allowing consideration of short-term economic concerns as part of the decision-making process for whether plants and animals should be protected in the first place.
Because there would be, as part of these new rules, a price tag on listing an animal. The government would tell everybody how much it would cost to protect that animal.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, Congress expressly excluded consideration of economic factors in what should be fundamentally a scientific decision. Is a species at risk of extinction or not? And, you know, these rules run directly counter to that directive.
Another rule change would weaken the protections for species that are called threatened, which is the precursor to them being endangered if things get worse for that species. What wildlife would be affected by that, do you think?
Oh, many species would be affected by that. What it does is, you know, up until this point, threatened species were getting the same protections as endangered species, and in particular, protections against killing, harming, harassing, or destroying their habitat. Now there will be, you know, tremendous political pressure to list species as threatened rather than endangered and to exempt particular industries from those protections. And so species that are under consideration where this is likely to happen include the American wolverine, which will almost certainly get listed as threatened, and they'll exempt, you know, projects that destroy their habitat. The monarch butterfly is up for consideration, and, you know, they'll likely exempt pollution from pesticides, which is, you know, a huge threat to them. So, you know, that provision in particular will really cause trouble for threatened and endangered species.
Noah, the changes would also make it more difficult for regulators to factor in the effects of climate change on some of these species.
Yeah, that's absolutely right in a couple ways. One of them is that they expressly state that species threatened by climate change won't get protected critical habitat, which is just completely nonsensical because species threatened by climate change need more critical habitat, not less. They need protection for areas that they can move into. It also makes it so that species threatened by climate change won't get protections from other federal agencies that are permitting, funding, or carrying out actions that harm them. The theory being that because they're not threatened by habitat destruction, we need not worry about habitat destruction, which again, you know, it's kind of like kicking a disease patient in the stomach.
Let's listen to the Interior Secretary, David Bernhardt, who said this about the rule changes yesterday.
I cannot stress enough that a more efficiently implemented act is more effective. Clarifying what actions should be considered during agency consultations will ensure that ESA implementation is more clear and consistent across agencies and even between our own field offices.
So Bernhardt says the changes will help improve conservation. How do you respond to that?
That's just completely untrue. The only way that this will be efficient is that species just won't get consideration at all. You know, the argument will be, we can just go ahead and destroy their habitat because they're threatened by climate change. And just even when I say that out loud, it's just nonsensical, and it's clear that that won't help species.
Well, and just to give people a sense of the value of the Endangered Species Act, you know, people have been pointing out that ever since it was signed into law by President Nixon in 1973, that the American bald eagle has been saved as a result of this act.
Yeah, that's right. More than 99% of species that have been protected under the Act still survive today, and hundreds have been put on the road to recovery and seen their numbers increase, the bald eagle being one. You know, we almost lost it entirely in the lower 48, and now you can see it in nearly every 50 states, and people see them every single day thanks to the Endangered Species Act.
That's Noah Greenwald, who is Endangered Species Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free.
Irving Berlin singing Give Me Your Tired, Your Poor. It's gorgeous. You can find lots of choral versions on YouTube. It's his musical version of Emma Lazarus's 1883 sonnet, The New Colossus, which she wrote to raise money for a pedestal for the Statue of Liberty, the poem eventually put on a plaque at the base. Well, the poem's getting a new look after the Trump administration announced a rule that will make it harder for poor, tired, legal immigrants to get a green card or a path to citizenship. They can be denied if they will need any aid if they're a charge of the public. When Ken Cuccinelli, acting director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, was asked today on Morning Edition about that poem, he kind of rewrote it.
Give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own two feet and who will not become a public charge. That plaque was put on the Statue of Liberty at almost the same time as the first public charge law was passed. Very interesting timing.
Let's bring in NPR's national correspondent, Tom Gelton. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Robin.
And you wrote a book on immigration, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. This public charge rule, poor legal immigrants can be denied green cards if they take aid like food stamps or housing. It's being called a new rule. So what does Cuccinelli mean? Start there. What does he mean that it goes back over a century?
Yeah, it does go back over a century, Robin. I mean, he got the dates a little bit wrong, but the language first appeared in U.S. legislation in 1882. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that it's, at this point, somewhat archaic language. Being considered a public charge back then was actually, you know, somewhat of a pejorative term. And people who were considered likely to become a public charge could be denied admission to the country, but it was taken very literally. I mean, it generally meant someone who was likely to become a public charge meant that you were so dependent on the government that the government would actually have to take care of you. If you were poor, you could be thrown into a poorhouse, for example, you know, where you'd be a charge of the state. There were, remember, so-called insane asylums. There were orphanages. This was all before there were social welfare programs, food stamps, Medicaid. So to say now that if you're getting any kind of assistance from the government, that means you're a public charge, that's really a major departure from where the way the term was used originally.
It's not being in the poorhouse. You might be working but still need food stamps, for instance, and you're legal. Look, Emma Lazarus's poem was a hopeful view of immigration. Not everyone agreed with her then. I mean, just how does that resonate with now?
You know, it's true that, you know, we sort of assume that that poem, because it is so widely cited, sort of represented U.S. policy at the time and U.S. attitudes about immigrants at the time. That's actually not true. It was very controversial at that time. That poem, as you say, was written at the end of the 19th century, and it was a time when there was a lot of concerns about immigration. There was a big immigration restriction movement at that time, and this was a time when we're beginning to see some new legislation that, you know, would target countries that supposedly sent less desirable immigrants.
Nice.
Emma Lazarus herself was a Sephardic Jew. Her family was Portuguese Jews. And in the late 19th century, one of the big immigration issues was whether to welcome Jews who were fleeing the pogroms in Tsarist Russia. Mm-hmm. Emma Lazarus was active in that movement. She was a volunteer for the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, which now known as HIAS, which still an active group. But, you know, on the other hand, there were a lot of people who were saying back then, yeah, we're getting too many immigrants and too many immigrants from countries we don't want immigrants from.
Well, Cuccinelli talks about his Italian ancestors pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, not being public charges. But there was a time when Italians and Poles were barred. It was thought they couldn't assimilate. Imagine that. The Chinese excluded. The president has spoken in vulgar language about not wanting people from blank hole countries. Just briefly, what will this do to the workforce if legal immigrants might be barred if they need some kind of assistance?
Well, one important fact, Robin, is that right now, 1 out of 5 people in the United States are on Medicaid, for example. So if you were to consider, I mean, this would be completely a departure from the way the term was originally used, to be considered that 1 out of 5 Americans is a public charge, is frankly ridiculous. And it would really gut, theoretically, the immigrant workforce, would hit the immigrant workforce very hard.
Yeah. These are, as we said, legal immigrants who could be barred from getting a green card if they need any government aid. NPR national correspondent Tom Gelton, thank you. We'll link people to your book. Thanks so much.
That's great. Thanks, Robin.
The Emmy Awards are coming up next month, and the Showtime limited series Escape at Dannemora has 12 nominations. It tells the story of how 2 inmates in far upstate New York were able to break out of prison in the summer of 2015. It stars Benicio del Toro and Paul Dano as the inmates, Richard Matt and David Sweat, and Patricia Arquette as Tilly Mitchell, the prison employee who helped them escape.
Tell me what you got.
I'll tell you what we got. We're busting the out of here.
Ben Stiller is the executive producer and director of Escape at Dannemora and joins us now. Ben Stiller, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So because of the way that we watch TV now, a lot of people probably watched the show when it was first released back in November. Some people will binge watch it this weekend after they hear this interview. Obviously, the Television Academy watched it and liked it. Why do you think this story about a prison break resonates with so many people?
Well, you know, I'm never good at figuring out why something does or doesn't resonate with an audience. And, you know, all I could go off of was my own interest in the story. And I think for me, when I heard about it, it was so fantastic, you know, the events that had happened. And I was very curious about how something like this could actually happen. And as we learn more about it and the human relationships that were going on in that prison between the people who work there and the inmates, that to me was really fascinating. And I think that's probably, I would imagine, for an audience, what's as interesting to them too is, you know, to watch how all this unfolds and what really happened.
And you wanted to get it exactly right. Accuracy was very important to you.
Yeah, and it was important to me only because I didn't know a lot about this world, and I felt almost concerned, or, you know, a little bit scared I was going to get it wrong. So I really kept on going back to what actually happened. And I thought, why not just try to just tell the story as realistically as possible? Because I think we've seen a lot of prison escape movies or television shows. And what's interesting to me about this one is that it actually happened. It's a real story. So how does that actually happen? What are the steps that occur? How do the relationships form, and who helped who, and how do you actually cut your way out of a cell in 2015
right,
without anybody knowing?
You know? Well, and you shot it in the actual prison, the Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, New York.
Yeah, we shot part of it there. We shot the prison yard scenes there because the yard there is very hard to recreate. And we shot the actual manhole that David Sweat and Richard Mack came out of. And then we shot in some other prisons too.
What did you learn about sort of prison life? There are so many people in prison in America that you didn't know before when you were putting this together.
One of the biggest things that just hit me at first was just how heavy and oppressive the feeling was in the prison. And that prison has been there, Clinton Correctional has been there for over 100 years, and you feel the weight of it. You know, as I got to know the people who were working there and the systems that are in place there, I learned a lot about what's not working in the prison system, which we know. I think, you know, if you're aware of what's going on in our country, we know that the prison system is flawed. But what I learned was that the corrections officers who work in these prisons are not motivated to really necessarily take chances that they would have to do their jobs really well because of how dangerous it is there's a sort of generational complacency that has happened in some of these prisons because people have worked there for years and years at very low pay, and there's not a lot of incentive to, mm-hmm. you know, to put yourself on the line. And then you see just how tough it is for the inmates too, and it doesn't feel very rehabilitational.
Which is supposed to be the point of the prison system.
Yeah. So, you know, you get that feeling like this isn't really helping people, though, you know, it's obviously a necessary thing. So that was part of, I think, for us telling the story was trying to show that ecosystem that exists in there and how all of those factors contributed to the escape.
Well, and I have to say that I was rooting for the prisoners to break out of prison as I was watching your show. Was that the idea?
Well, I think to a certain extent, we wanted you to see why you'd want to get out of prison. I mean, obviously, the idea of being in prison, you know, you could understand why you didn't want to be there. But to actually see what the day-to-day life was in there, especially for these two inmates, was important, I think, so you could sort of get why they were working so hard to get out. But then also we wanted to let the audience know what they did to get in there so that at a certain point, you know, if you are rooting for them, which you're going to be because they're the protagonists, you're also going to be hopefully a little confused as to, you know, why you're rooting for them if they've done these.
Oh, yes. They are murderers. Right. That's right. Yes, I should keep that in the back of my head.
These guys were on the honor block of the prison, which was the place you went if you were on good behavior and you had special privileges. And that had nothing to do with what your crime was that you committed. It was just based on your behavior in the prison. So some really bad people had special privileges within that honor block.
So as you mentioned, Patricia Arquette plays Tilly Mitchell, who is the prison employee who helps the inmates, Richard Madden, David Sweat, played by Benicio del Toro and Paul Dano, escape from prison. I want to listen to a scene here with inmate Matt and Tilly in a back room in the sewing workshop.
My husband never looks at me.
Baby. I want to paint pretty pictures for you. But I want to do them right on stretched canvas and make frames. But I need better tools.
What do you need?
Hacksaw blades.
He says he needs hacksaw blades which she provides for him. Do you think that it would be possible – there are a lot of questions I have about that. But do you think it would be possible for them to have broken out without the help of somebody who worked at the prison?
No. I mean they needed to get the tools smuggled in and they needed, you know, access. There are things that just happen in the everyday life of the prison, like being allowed to go in the catwalks to fix electrical circuitry if there's an inmate who does that well, or – in Richard Matt's case, to hide his paints because he had a relationship with Gene Palmer, who was one of the corrections officers who, you know, he would give paintings to. So there was this sort of barter relationship. And that type of thing goes on all the time mm-hmm. in prisons. It doesn't necessarily always lead to an escape. And the same thing in terms of physical relations between prisoners and prison workers, that happens all the time. I talked to somebody at Clinton who told me that what happened between Tilly and Richard Matt and David Sweat, which is basically, you know, having sexual relations in the back, had happened many, many times at Clinton over the last 20 years that he was aware of. It just never was really brought out because there wasn't an escape that it resulted in.
And Tilly is in prison now herself because of
yes,
what she did.
Yes, she is. Yeah. Yeah. She was just recently denied parole.
Wow. While we have you, Ben Stiller, I have to ask you about some other things because we don't get to talk to Ben Stiller every day. a lot of people, of course, know you for your comedy work. There's Something About Mary, Meet the Fockers, Zoolander, Arrested Development, Curb Your Enthusiasm, etc. And also recently Saturday Night Live, where you played somebody who's now in prison, President Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. Here's a clip from that.
Mr. Trump, I don't know what to do. You keep changing your story on the Stormy Daniels payment.
Look, let's get Rudy Giuliani on the phone. He'll fix this. He's got the sharpest legal mind since my cousin Vinny.
Okay, but just to be safe, let me call you back on one of my burner phones.
Wait, you kept the burner phones? That's not good.
So now that Cohen is in jail, are you not going to be back this season on SNL playing him?
You know, you never know. I'm assuming if he stays in jail, I will stay off the air. But you never know, because on SNL, you get the call like on Thursday or Friday sometimes that they're going to do the show the next day, depending on what happened in the news. But I'm hoping that it's a little bit of a respite.
Is there something about your comedic background that made you want to do a serious program like this one, like Escape at Dannemora?
I don't know if it's my comedic background as much. It's just I was just always wanting to make movies. You know, since I was 9 or 10 years old, I knew I wanted to be a director. And the movies that I grew up watching were dramas and comedies. And, you know, in the '70s, the genres were a little less well defined. You know, and I think there were movies that were very serious that had humor in them, and you know, a lot of the comedies were a lot more edgy and realistic. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing was, for me, influenced me a lot. You know, the movies I think you see when you're a kid really stick with you. So I think that's what it was more than anything.
Do you like being behind the scenes as much as being on screen?
I would say that I might like it more, actually. I love acting and I love the experience of it. But it's a very, very specific thing that I feel like you're constantly trying to figure it out. But as a director, what I enjoy is that you kind of have a sense of what you want the thing to be, and then things happen within it that are totally different than you ever imagined. But having that sort of point of view about, you know, the creative project, to me, I think I do enjoy that more. And I love the collaboration of working with actors. I love watching actors work and having a chance to, you know, maybe collaborate with them in some way to bring out their best and let them have the freedom to do their thing. And so I think I do enjoy it more.
Okay, I want to ask you one more question before we let you go, just because I'm an enormous fan of Seinfeld, which, of course, your dad was on.
Yes.
What is your favorite Seinfeld episode?
You know, the Manzier episode?
Oh, the Manzier, right.
Yes.
Or the bro.
Yeah, the bro, right. That always stuck with me, maybe because it was my dad.
That was your dad, right.
That was promoting it.
That is Ben Stiller, who is director and executive producer of the Showtime limited series Escape at Dannemora, which has been nominated for 12 Emmys. Ben Stiller, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, man.
And if you haven't seen it already, it's only 7 episodes. I binge-watched it. You can, too. A new high school is about to open for its first full year of school in Ohio. It's aimed at helping teens with addiction learn in a safe environment while they recover. Heartland High School is the first recovery school in Ohio. WOSU's Paige Flager reports from Columbus.
There's a psychology one as an elective. Mm-hmm. I would take that, but I already took psychology and sociology. And I feel like Heartland in general is a psychology class.
Alyssa is one of 5 students at Heartland High, a recovery school in Columbus, Ohio, for students who have struggled with substance abuse. We're not using Alyssa's last name to protect her privacy. She started using drugs and drinking when she was 13.
Drugs was what I thought was curing my depression and really helping me through those times, which, you know, turns out only made it worse.
After a suicide attempt, Alyssa went to Utah for a treatment program. She learned coping mechanisms alongside other teens who were trying to be sober. But when she came back to Ohio and started school, peer pressure made it hard to remember what she learned.
All these people are attacking me and saying, oh, you're lame because, you know, you don't want to go to an after party for homecoming, whatever. And I was like, I don't want to use drugs. I don't smoke. I don't drink anymore.
Alyssa relapsed. She overdosed on pills. Her experience is common, says the head of Heartland, Dr. Paige Stewart.
When you go and you go back to your school of origin, you know, you're around the same people that you used with before, the same people that might be dealing to you. You're around the same stressors, and now even more stressors, because now you're that kid that comes back to school that's been to rehab.
The National Institute on Drug Abuse found that nearly all students returning to their old school after treatment reported being offered drugs on the first day. Stewart says peer support and access to a recovery coach are vital parts of Heartland's success.
There's a lot of supports out there for, you know, adults who are in recovery, but there's not as much for kids. And so the wonderful thing about recovery high schools and what the research is showing is now these parents and these children have support.
Heartland is one of fewer than 50 recovery schools across the country. Like many recovery schools, it's starting off small, with about 5 to 15 students. Research on these small-scale schools is limited, but Vanderbilt professor Andrew Finch says outcomes have been encouraging.
The scientific findings have shown so far that you do see a positive effect of having a recovery high school, even for a short period of time, in a person's life.
Finch is co-founder of the Association of Recovery Schools. In a 2017 peer-reviewed study, he and a co-researcher found that recovery schools have a variety of beneficial effects.
We looked at substance use, we looked at mental health, we looked at educational outcomes, and what we found was that the recovery high school students did better than the non-recovery high school students.
While students come to school every day, classes at Heartland are online. Students get individualized academic plans, which helps them make up for time spent in treatment. Since Heartland is a private school, that success comes at a price. The regular school tuition costs $20,000. The summer program, $500. Heartland is also looking for funding to offer scholarships for students enrolled in the upcoming full school year. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager in Columbus.
Tomorrow marks 7 years since journalist Austin Tice was detained by supporters of the Assad government at a checkpoint in Damascus, Syria, as he reported on the civil war that had just exploded there. All we've seen of him since then, a video 5 weeks later, Austin panicking, being forced to say Muslim prayers. His parents recently published an open letter in the Washington Post, which carried his reporting. Mark and Deborah Tice wrote, "Every single day, Austin remains in detention. His story is current, ongoing news. Each time the sun rises on another day, now more than 2,540 days, almost 7 years." Well, this week, a group of news organizations launched a new initiative to try to make that true, to put Austin Tice in the news. It's called AskAboutAustin.org. We've spoken to Mark and Deborah Tice over the years, carefully for their son's safety. They join us again from the studios of KUHF in Houston. Deborah, are you there?
I am. Thank you so much for having us, Robin.
Well, Mark, you're there as well?
Yes, I am. It's good to talk to you again.
Well, it is good to speak with you, and yet I keep hoping we're going to have a different conversation, and I'm still convinced we will.
We will down
the road. But we remember when we spoke in 2015. You were critical at that time of the hostage negotiation process. This was 3 years in. You thought you weren't getting help from either the Syrian or the U.S. government. Are you still feeling that frustration?
We don't have frustration with the United States government. We do have support across the administration, from the White House to the State Department. And, of course, we have a special presidential envoy. We still have frustration on the Syrian side because they have not engaged with us in these 7 years.
Yeah. $1 million reward was offered by the FBI. That was matched by some media organizations that got together. And reportedly, there were new sources of information coming forward. You said this, Mark, in December. Is that still the same, that you're feeling like there might be an uptick in information, at least because of those rewards?
Well, yes. And that's frankly why we are so happy in a horrible way to mm-hmm. be talking to you again, because mm-hmm. every time Austin's situation gets broad exposure, it increases the chance that people are going to hear it, people mm-hmm. that might actually know something. And that was the case when the reward was first issued, coupled with regional advertising and notices that Reporters Without Borders put out. And it did trigger some folks' memories, and it did generate some contacts that were relevant to Austin.
But we remember, we thought we were seeing reports that Austin Tice, might be near release. Were there moments where something fell through?
Yes, there was a critical moment. We were quite hopeful in 2016 that we were very close to his release, and bureaucracy happened on this side of the pond, and so it couldn't go forward.
Well, what do you mean? Can you be more specific, or?
I could be more specific, but it wouldn't be prudent.
Yeah. Well, let me put it this way, Robin. One of the things that that we've had to deal with, and, you know, I always have to interject that what we're dealing with is trivial, you know, compared to what Austin is dealing with, right? But we have turnover. We have people change assignments if they're in, say, the State Department or the FBI. We had an election in 2016, so there was a, you know, full flip of senior positions in our government. So it becomes difficult to maintain momentum that's developed when you have a changing cast.
Well, talk about that. 7 years, and you're looking, if I've got this right, not just at the anniversary of his disappearance, but wasn't his birthday?
Yes, his birthday was Sunday, and he was 38 years old on Sunday. It's one of my favorite days, just remembering the very first time I got to meet him and hold him and look into his eyes. It's still one of the best memories of my life.
Well, you're killing me now because I can't imagine. I mean, that, you know, it could also be a horrible day, especially coupled in this week with the day that he disappeared. But you say it was, you make it a beautiful day. How are you doing? How are you doing this?
Well, you know, we're doing it like we have from the beginning. I'd like to think we're a little smarter now, but, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Austin's still detained, so apparently we haven't gotten smart enough. But, you know, every day that comes around, we're trying to think of something to do. People reach out to us. We reach out to them. You know, knowing that Austin's alive, knowing that he will come home. Everything we do is around making that happen faster.
I mean, a terrible question, but how do you know he's alive?
Well, we know he's alive because we've had information from the highest level of our government that he is. Mm. And they were willing to make that statement publicly for the first time. The special presidential envoy, the office of the special presidential envoy, spoke publicly, said Austin is definitely alive. We never had any doubt. And also, there's no news to the contrary, which I can tell you, as a military mom, you very quickly learn no news is good news.
Yeah. Well, again, you remind us, Austin, a graduate of the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, a Marine officer. He was enrolled at Georgetown Law. He wanted to be a reporter. And so he took himself to Syria when it was not authorized to do so. Very, very dangerous time. And he was leaving just when he was detained and taken.
One thing that we haven't pursued aggressively that I think we could change course on is I would like to consider pursuing Austin's release through judicial process. He was undoubtedly, undisputably, he was in the country without the proper documentation, and there is a penalty for that, and that is how the American and the Canadian were recently released, through a very functional judicial process in Syria.
You know, charge him with that, and then, you know, let him go. What do you, it's 7 years, what do you do every day?
Pray first, pray in the middle, pray at the end.
Yeah, absorb as much information as we can, you know, all the news of the region, all the political and geopolitical news, and just looking for information that might create an opportunity or an opening or name of someone that might be influential that we could get in touch with.
Well, meantime, you're not taking any chances. You are asking for everyone's help. You want people to pray for Austin's return, share his story on social media. The hashtag is FreeAustinTice. Use your access to people in power to mention Austin. Urge the president and secretary of state to make it a priority. Journalists, ask questions if there's an opportunity. Military veterans, raise your voice. Students, scouts. You just want everybody to elevate it. We're going to post your open letter so people can read it. But what do you say to people who might say, you know what, the best way to do this is just keep it quiet and keep it behind the scenes and just, you know, the negotiating?
Well, you know, Robin, that water is way under the bridge. Yeah. It became public without any action of ours. You know, while that might be really good advice if a family, individuals are involved in immediate discussions and negotiations, but that's not where we are. Mm-hmm. It's where we want to be. So enlisting support and spreading awareness is one of the best things we can do.
That's Mark Tice, along with his wife, Deborah Tice. They are parents of Austin Tice, last seen detained in Damascus 7 years ago. Deborah and Mark, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Right. Thank you, Robin. Always ask about Austin.
By the way, is that, do you say that to friends as well? Are people like afraid to talk to you about Austin because you'll get upset?
No, I always wear a Free Austin Tice pin because I want that conversation.
Yeah.
And so people will say, what's that? Or who's that? Or so for me, it's keeping that door open. Please, please ask me. Please talk to me about my son.
And that is the name of the new initiative created to help create awareness about Austin Tice, a website from the National Press Club, The Washington Post, and others. It's called askaboutaustin.org. Mark Tice says initiatives like this one help keep them and Austin's six siblings going.
In a dispute that could go all the way to the Supreme Court, Domino's is being sued for not making its popular pizza delivery website accessible to the blind. And this particular case, brought by Guillermo Robles, is not the only one. According to CNBC, lawsuits over inaccessible websites jumped 58% last year over the year before. Joining us now is Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, just explain why Guillermo Robles is suing Domino's.
The short answer, Jeremy, is that he wants to be able to order pizza, and he's blind. He has tried in recent years to use the company's website and mobile app in order to order a custom pie and just hasn't been able to. And this case is interesting because it sort of exposes this thing that a lot of non-disabled people don't think about. The internet is pretty hard to access for a portion of the population that has disability. The obvious one we might think about is people who are blind or visually impaired, but it's also worth remembering that there are lots of people who might have difficulty typing or using a touchscreen, for instance. And we do so much of our commerce on the internet now. Guillermo is suing because Domino's, which I think at last check was technically the largest pizza chain in the U.S., mm-hmm. does not provide an accessible version of its website.
Well, and they say that making the changes that would be necessary here would be prohibitively expensive. How much are we talking about?
So the Domino's estimate is around $3 million for building some accessibility functionality into their website. This is, by the way, less than 1/100th of the company's net income in 2018. The company revenue that year was $3.5 billion, just mm-hmm. for a little perspective there. But the company's larger point and argument seems to be the old sort of if one company has to do it, everyone will have to do it, and what a mess that will be argument. Basically, that if this case is ruled on in favor of the plaintiff here by the Supreme Court eventually, then it will sort of set a precedent for all kinds of companies to have to build separate accessible websites and web portals for users, and that this will cost billions of dollars to American businesses.
Well, and the other thing that Domino's says is that, you know, we could make it accessible to the visually impaired, but there may be other disabilities that we then have to make our website work for as well. What does the law say about accommodating disabilities like blindness? I mean, we know that in a brick and mortar restaurant, for example, you would be required to have a wheelchair accessible ramp.
Right. And this is part of the reason that this case might eventually reach the Supreme Court, right? The argument Robles is making here is that the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act, which requires businesses to make themselves accessible, among other things, covers any website that is attached to a business with a brick and mortar location. So when it comes to people who are blind, a lot of the ADA seems to point towards its main goal of preventing discrimination against people with disabilities. And there's a lot there about requirements for employers, for instance. But the basic idea here and the argument being made by Robles is that if brick and mortar locations are supposed to make themselves accessible under the ADA for someone who might use a wheelchair to give the business patronage, the same idea should apply when someone who is visually impaired wants to frequent an online business. And if they don't, it's a form of discrimination.
In the meantime, are there third-party apps out there that could help for example, read the text of a website like Domino's aloud to somebody who is visually impaired?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a growing number of accessibility applications already built into the devices we use right off the factory floor. That should, you know, we should say that. You can usually find that stuff in the accessibility settings of a device you're using. There are also a lot of third-party companies getting into this game. You know, accessible tech is a growth area in the tech world right now. There's a company called Dragon, for instance, that does a lot of voice recognition software. One of my favorite companies doing this sort of thing is called Be My Eyes. It's a really interesting company. It's been around for some years now. It basically allows people to volunteer and video chat with people who are low vision or visually impaired and use the video feed to guide those folks or help them answer a question. Mm-hmm. So this is absolutely a growing area of tech innovation. But again, the argument in the case we're talking about here is that the law should require the companies themselves to provide their own versions of this so that people with disabilities aren't left out in the tech-forward economy of the 21st century.
Well, and of course, at the moment, I think you can still call Domino's the old-fashioned way on the phone, which wouldn't require any of this.
Yes,
But I mean, having said that, maybe in the future, Domino's goes away from that altogether, and so therefore something like this would be more important.
Yeah, and as you and I both know, probably it's harder and harder to find, let alone call the number, let alone get a human on the other end of the phone all the time. So it is a tricky question.
That is Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.